We're dedicated to remain here and watch the show of, I don't know what to call it.
Well, that's a telltale sign. We don't really know what to call it.
Well, I'm here for the goods.
Yeah. Right. We can see you.
Hey, Jack.
Hi. What's happening in your world?
Boring stuff.
Good to know.
I watched this, rewatched The Sixth Sense today. That was exciting.
Oh. Yeah. Were you just as surprised the second time as you were the first?
No, but I really enjoyed it, you know, and I think it's so obvious. He's a ghost. How can you not see that the first time? It's like crazy, you know? But.
Yeah. He's a lot like us.
Yeah, he doesn't know he's not alive.
He finally moves on, right?
He finally moves on. He finally realizes he's a ghost. I think that allows him to move on. Like, he has a conversation with his wife while she's sleeping. He realizes he's dead.
Yeah.
And then...
What's your excuse?
I need some spooky little kid to tell me, you know.
Let's go in search of a spooky little kid.
Yeah.
To remind us that we're dead.
Yeah.
Curious quest.
Yeah.
Why not?
I don't know what happened to M. Night Shyamalan after that. Like, now his movies suck, but that was a good movie, you know. I guess we don't need to turn this into a movie review kind of show.
Siskel and Jeff.
We don't really know what else to do. Except comment on pop culture.
Yeah.
I was listening to that video you suggested between Deepak Chopra and Sadhguru.
Yeah, I confess to only watching a little of it, but what did you think of that guy?
Well, you know, he was asked an interesting question where, you know, he maybe could have looked at things from a more, you know, dynamic point of view, but instead, the first question he was asked about, you know, what is his thinking now is contrasted with his thinking, you know, from a decade ago. He had to make it about his magical yogic powers by saying that he had no thoughts. And it's like, hey, Sadhguru, first of all, you're a liar. And second of all, fuck you.
Well, I did hear him say that. And I was like, look at Mr. Big No Thought over there, you know? Like,
yeah, see, that's the problem. Then you pan to the audience, and the whole audience is kind of in this, yeah, you know, awed, enviable frame of shock. Like, wow. wouldn't I be, like, so completely different if I had no thoughts? And so instead of, you know, responding to the audience in a more respectful manner, in terms of looking at the dimension of awake that might be presently amongst them, he, like any Indian narcissist with silk robes will do, is call attention to themselves. And then once you've called attention to yourself and established the fact that you're a somewhat of an enviable superhuman being, you know, or spiritual adept, accomplished spiritual adept, then you can go on and speak with authority about a bunch of shit that doesn't really make amount to a hill of beans, or maybe I should say a hill of dal. And yet the audience, you know, I mean, I didn't get too far into it, remain somewhat mesmerized and grateful that they've been in the company of this, you know, most wonderful Mahatma. And you're like, okay, so everyone had a spiritual circle jerk and now you can all go home. And Deepak Chopra, of course, does the same thing. You know, he remarks incessantly on the exotic nature of reality. Again, setting himself up as either, you know, an aspirant or an adept of this miraculous reality. And then more or less convinces everyone why they should, you know, go to the Deepak Chopra Center for Ayurvedic healing. I mean, the whole thing is just it rotates around this banal materialism that even these Indian guys, you know, are capable of succumbing to. Yeah, I mean, for the gentleman to say he goes for days at a time without thought, you know, that's just Indian big shotism. Yeah. But that comes out of the, you know, the whole chauvinistic culture of Patanjaliism, where from a heroic point of view, the man, you know, and maybe the women can tag along if they want, you know, but pretty much they should remain in the kitchen. But if they want to tag along, then it's our job that, you know, we should control our thoughts, be masters of our thinking. So that comes out of, you know, heroic, somewhat chauvinistic Patanjaliism in a misogynistic, you know, culture like India.
Are you master of your domain?
Yeah, that's right. And that's how it sets up, you know, these so-called, you know, humble bowing guys as unrepentant egomaniacs. I mean, that's how it works. That's, you know, that's the whole Indian frame. I mean, it's very entertaining. It's charming in its own right. But I think a lot of those, you know, gurus, accomplished or otherwise, I think they missed the boat. And instead of, you know, could say assisting the audience with a vivid or vital examination of reality itself, they just end up becoming boastful pundits. And that doesn't help or assist anybody. It's just attention seeking. Deepak Chopra's entire career is that. First, let me hook your attention by pointing out that I have enviable spiritual accomplishments, and now I can run off all kinds of blather and bullshit, and you'll kindly, you know, pay me to do that. And if I'm wearing a turban and a, you know, a well-coiffed beard and silk clothing by a nice candle, then, you know, total package.
Sorry.
Is that Commissioner Gordon?
I got your Batman reference, but you didn't get my Seinfeld reference.
Which one? I'm sorry.
The Master of My Domain.
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
Was that a whole show was dedicated to that theme?
Oh, yeah.
It was a masturbation contest. Who could go without it?
I see. The Master of My Domain.
They'd say, are you the master of your domain?
Yeah. I should spend more time watching salient reruns.
It's either that or a Sod Guru. I mean,
Or a Sod Guru. Take it or leave it, baby.
Yeah.
So the typically you might come together with people from a kind of what's in it for me perspective, right? Because audiences tend not to meld so well together. An audience or a gathering like this, you know, we're trained, if you will, you know, to be in an audience, to enjoy the concert through our ears, to enjoy the conversation or the message or the teaching, you know, as it relates to our experience. And what we do fail to notice or fail to see, or which is very rarely encouraged, is that simply being together and hanging out with whatever quality of attention creates its own, suggests its own potent dreamscape. So we are the concert. Whatever your life is or isn't, for at least right now, it brought you what we say might be here. Your life brought you here. And so this is the entirety of the miraculous presentation of your life right about now. You know, but we rarely settle down enough to feel that might even be remotely so. Instead, we just fill our day with, you know, whatever diversions and appointments and entertainments or obligations we fill our day with. But we're always, you know, kind of skimming through our experience. We're always kind of moving toward whatever we're planning or hoping is next. Right? So we skim through the presentation of present experience. And that skimming, which is the nature of time, never permits us to, you could say, rest in the miracle that is so, because we're creatures, we're objects, you know, in a kind of a stream force, and always succumb to distraction, skimming. And we wonder why we're missing something, or maybe we wonder what the fuck do we have to do to so-called wake up, whatever that might imply. And then we continue skimming, right, through most of the so-called spiritual search or the efforts that we make for wisdom or insight. We're still kind of skimming. Our alliances are pretty much with anywhere else but here. And it's kind of a shock, I think, that if that hidden, sublimated momentum of becoming can just shut down, then this presentation is we're no longer skimming. We're intimately present with the texture of being, because we're not slaves to time, and we're not skimming, and we're not distracting ourselves from the vantage point of being, you know, a creature in time. So then this present moment, as if it were one, turns out to be both the portal and the fruition of the cessation of longing. You can't find the cessation of longing in your future. Because that means you're just skimming and aiming for a day that will never arrive. And you sure can't find this lusciousness in your past, because that's just anecdotal and virtual. The living texture of the past is gone. And the living texture of the present is, right, ongoingly evaporating. So there's nothing actually to hold on to. Not an object, not a thought, not a sentiment, not an emotion. You can't cling to emptiness. You can only cling to a virtual representation of emptiness. That's the difference, you could say, between the samsaric presentation and the nirvanic presentation. You can't cling to what's actually so, because it's only evaporative and it's appearing non-representationally. You can only cling to your imagination of what's so, which is the culmination of meme and metaphor. So freedom is absurdly at hand and also miraculously well hidden. If we drop time, bless you.
Bless you.
Then this present appearing is more than sufficient. I mean, it's unspeakable. But that means that our consciousness has to be sufficiently at rest that we can just mellow the fuck out exactly with what we're feeling, or that feeling is so, texture is so, experiencing is occurring. We back off from having an idea about what it is we should do with it, which places us once again in the role of seeker, of time, of future. The presence or absence of thoughts is inconsequential. Therefore, to be boastful about not thinking or not having thoughts for several days on end is a superficial, boastful agenda. It has nothing to do with the right presentation of reality. The presence or absence of thoughts are inconsequential. So why be chasing something we imagine to be freedom, when if we can back off from the reflex to chase, what this actually is, you could say, trumps freedom. Freedom is still an idea that might only appear to be attractive when contrasted with not freedom, which is another idea. So the dropping of not freedom and the dropping of the idea of freedom leaves us with this. It just leaves us with this, and there's no creature here. The movement or mellifluousness of perception is not conjuring a creature. It's not occurring through the lens of a creature. This way you liberate where you are. Truly, we can only liberate where and when we are by seeing that it's not binding. That the apparitional nature, the force of consciousness itself is not binding. So we're not wiggling away from anything or wiggling out of anything or being entranced by someone's boastful spiritual horseshit. I think there's a difference between being a presenter and being capable, that includes us on the call, being capable of, you could say, resting. And for a while, this resting becomes part of your experiential arsenal. You know, it's like, oh, I've done good noticing or good resting or good whatever, you know, good vipassana, good jhanic practice. But what happens, I believe, is this resting sneaks up on us, and instead of being a part of our experiential arsenal, it becomes the right, the predominant reality. We still want to be someone, you know, who's benefiting from spiritual accoutrement, spiritual accomplishment, or some kind of experience that we might like to have on demand, like we do our entertainment. We want our entertainment and our burgers on demand. Resting in being then takes upstages skimming. So resting is no longer an accoutrement of self, it's the primacy of our attention. Sometimes it's like we're living our lives and I get a few moments of, you know, intelligence here and a few minutes of true wonder there. And maybe my day and my week is punctuated by, you know, true intimacy, right? Really, really nourishing or riveting revelation. Well, imagine flipping that around so that your actual relationship with living was of the nature of this quiet, attentive, you know, revelatory nature. And you get visited by your life a couple times a week instead. And this preoccupation that we have with our lives and our plans and what we must do and must not do, you know, you can see, if you're willing to look at it, that it doesn't really amount to much. Your present experience is not the consequence or product of all of the demands and all the decisions and all the pining that we've done. This present moment is absolutely autonomous, stands alone, is not the consequence of anything we've done or thought or felt or said prior to this moment. Which, you know, maybe is a little insulting in that all of this emphasis that we place on being the best creature that we can possibly be turns out to be foolish, moot. And if that were the case, then your present consciousness or your present sensitivity is all there is. Unburdened by whatever we might be proud of or might regret from the imagination of a past. We're always exploring present experience by feeling it. But we think we want something to happen, or we want to make something happen, or we want to entertain ourselves or justify why we do this and why we do that and what's the value of it. So we're always kind of seduced or pushed back into living vicariously, living virtually, through impulse to impulse to impulse, craving an end to impulse when we just keep living from impulse to impulse to impulse. There's nothing right or wrong with living from impulse to impulse to impulse. It's the way that we do, right? It's the way that we, you could say, superficialize the nature of our own experience by thinking or feeling through the lens of the creature, the restlessness, and the time-bound identity of the creature. Why can't we get used to resting in present experience, relieved of the badge of the creature? What's in it for me? How will this benefit me and my future? How did I do a minute ago, a day ago, a year ago, a lifetime ago? Present experience turns out to be rapturous. But we do a Debbie Downer on the rapturous nature of present experience by running it through the pasta maker of time, of self. We might think we have to be under the influence of some kind of drug to rest in the presentation of transcendence. Any questions? Are you feeling it, or am I just blowing smoke up your ass?
I thought that was the feeling it.
I feel sometimes memory creates anticipation.
They're the same, right? Memory is anticipation, even if you're looking backwards.
Mm-hmm. So in a way, in listening, sometimes hard for me because there is a kind of objectification going on when we speak of present experience.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, we're that quick. We do. We objectify present experience through the filter of metaphor and so-called knowledge and association. That's what drives us crazy. That's why the species is doomed. Because all of the irritability that, you know, we might see in the gross behavior of a troubled species is exactly that point. We drive ourselves insane because we filter the emptiness of present experience through the insistence, spontaneously appearing insistence on creature, which is the objectification of present experience. That's why we're crazy. You know, it's like someone gave Tinkerbell like a fairy wand and an Uzi. You know, she picked up the Uzi. That's us. We picked up the Uzi. We should have went for the wand. You know, but like those sanguine sages will say, hey, we didn't do this. Consciousness and its modus operandi is, you know, the outgassing of something of a higher order. So it's not like humans made a belligerent error. We trade the pursuit of stuff and the pursuit of influence for having nothing. Having nothing is where all the magic is. Pursuing stuff and influence is, it's a sickness. The light's gone out. Tinkerbell grabbed the Uzi.
One thing that I'm trying to understand is that, you know, when if I say sincerely, there's this discovery here that I'm here to find or to make. And at the same time, I don't know whether I'm bullshitting myself or not, whether this is just, you know, another accessory that I want to add to, you know, my string of experiences, or is there something?
Yes, you want there's to persist.
Something else that's really calling.
We want to persist as the experiencer, being visited upon by pleasant, if not spiritually affirming, experiences. That's the dilemma. So see if you can reach into the marrow of the myth of experiencing and let it go. right? If we keep trying to perfect experience, then, you know, we remain beggars. Something, you could say, shockingly fundamental has to drop out from the bottom.
How do we do that?
That's right. Well, I have a correspondence course that I'm starting next week.
Why buy the cow when you can get the milk for free?
Yeah.
At Panera.
Then you get like a decoder ring and an invisibility cloak and x-ray goggles for the guys only. That's how.
I guess the women should be grateful that, you know, they're spared that extra thing.
Exactly. Yeah, it's that's right. The thoughtfulness is in their direction. So that's all that's present, is this which need not be affirmed. By peering so innocently into the nature of experience, maybe it's possible to see that it's not binding. By peering so intimately into the nature of experience and to discover that it's not binding, then one no longer has a craving that experience should deliver something of a preferential nature. That's a different arc, right? When Deepak Chopra and his silken-robed fakirs sell superficialities, they do so because their audience is still craving idealized spiritual experience, which is absolute bullshit. What you really want to aim for is to penetrate the mystery of experiencing itself, discover that it is not binding, so it can appear and do what it pleases. But that's some pretty fucking weird shit when you really sense the implications of it. Because our whole habit is to grapple with and grasp at experiencing from the vantage point of being the experiencer. And the experiencer is drunk with the texture of experiencing as a creature. But what if that foundational way that we relate to so-called living is of the nature of a myth? Right? Look at the foundational certainty of how we relate to living and maybe consider, be open to the possibility that it's a myth. So the reflex to grasp or to conjure or to plan or to place yourself in idealized circumstances in your future just drops, really drops. it's hard for us to kind of imagine ourselves untethered from self, untethered from time, untethered from creature. All of our efforts and investigations often have to do with some form of what's in it for me, some form of time, some form of the recognition of disappointment or malnourishment and what it is we should do about it. Doesn't it make sense that as long as we take ourselves to be a creature, that this existential malnourishment is always present? We're uncertain with our own view. We're unconvinced with our own view, but we don't know what to do about it. Maybe we can get healing or falafel.
Lemurian healing sessions at the Unitarian Church.
Yes, I think we should wear a crystal skull on our head and be healed by a Lemurian crystal while eating falafel.
I think Stephen should come down for that. You know.
Generous heapings of tahini. Tahina. Everyone's a fraud.
I don't know how to describe it, but the word or the phrase that is coming to me is an accident has to occur.
Yeah. And you're in luck because that accident is this that is so. You could say as we learn to feel this or interface with present experience through texture, through the feeling of it, not the naming of it, that we get glimpses into its, ambiguity, boundarylessness, some might say vastness. But I think vastness is a little weird because it still suggests a vista of some kind. Mm. This is vista-less. If it were vast, it would still be constrained by some idea of volume. But it has no observable or felt volume. Not spatially, not temporally, not from the point of view of genesis or outcome. I mean, what if our actual nature was completely off planet? What if? Then all that appears as our life or the lives of others squeaking by on the surface of planet Earth could turn out to be kind of a trivial entertainment. We're trying to solve a lot of our, behavior, spiritual and otherwise, is solving. And solving is time. Solving is self. Solving is inextricably adhered to the myth of becoming. By feeling and looking at the nature, the texture, the geometry of how our so-called consciousness is operating, that creates a, you know, a different vantage point of intelligence. This way we're not looping within the same familiar realms or electron orbits of our former intelligence, but we're able to see experience itself through a meta lens, and then another meta lens, meaning, you know, suggesting wider aperture, a broader electron orbit. And as our, you could say, our, the quality of our perception widens in scope and subtlety, and we're not under the influence of local weather. You know, if you stub your toe and you lose your wallet, you know, you sure can say, fuck. And, you know, that local weather or the crisis of the body, you know, or the crisis of practicalities can certainly be consuming. And we're not suggesting that those should be somehow superficially transcended. Shit, Gabriel Cousins said he was enlightened and he lost his wallet. I was there. He left it on the roof of the car after he paid for gasoline on the way to Tucson. The fire department found the wallet on the side of the road a couple days later. Gabriel may have been enlightened, but I was the one that paid for dinner. Because I hadn't lost my wallet. He got all the accolades and I paid for dinner. Jesus Christ. If I'd known, I would have thrown my wallet in the fucking desert. Hey, I'm enlightened too. I've lost my wallet. Then his wife would have had to pay for dinner. But knowing her, I'm sure she would have like thrown her purse, you know, in a dumpster and said, I can't find my purse. That must mean I'm enlightened too. I don't know who he would have pinned it on if it went down like that.
We wish it were so simple.
Yeah, really. Yeah, just throw your wallet out the window and you're good. I have seen the Tetragrammaton and thrown my wallet from the window. I dare you to challenge my awakening. Oh, God. What other magical shit we can pretend to have occur so people will envy us? If present experience isn't about anything, I mean, really, if it's not about anything, yeah, not what's on TV, not the debates, the election, the fate of polar bears on thin ice. the fate of ourselves on thin ice. What happens to our, you could say, the momentum of our so-called psyche if this is not about anything? Wow. And we don't really have to go on a lecture circuit or convince anyone of anything or draw attention to ourselves by virtue of our hard-won spiritual accomplishments. This isn't about anything for anyone, for anything. It's just not about anything. What could possibly be accomplished? It's like the moment we try to orient toward some kind of spiritual succor or amelioration of confusion or frustration, we place ourselves back in the game. We're back in the imagination that this is about something, and I can tell myself what it is that this is about. Because I can rattle off all kinds of frustrations and curiosities or imagined insufficiencies, because after all, this is about something and I can't possibly be experiencing it to the max. But that's just clutter. We invest in clutter, then we invest in trying to solve the clutter, then we invest in how successful or unsuccessful we've been with our uncluttering mandate. And all we do is remain under the influence of clutter. See, if we don't assign anything to anything at present, well, then you can't convince yourself of some kind of imagined insufficiency. Through the assignment is birthed the imagination of insufficiency. It's true. Through the very assignment is birthed the imagination of insufficiency. Then we're off on a mission from God to solve the alleged insufficiency. We've got vows and jackets and plaques and buttons and beds of nails and all other forms of accoutrements to prove that we are absolutely committed to this mission that we're on from God to remedy imagined insufficiency. Why
does seem to does seem to be feel like a hard wiring?
No, it's not. It's not as hard as we think, because if you catch it now, it's not so you could say engulfing. We only think that it's hardwired when we refer to memory. Makes it look like it's got, you know, big thighs. Broad shoulders. It doesn't. Delusion is not big. It's tiny. It's non-threatening. It's tiny. Delusion is very tiny. Fragile. Shy, even. present experience that is felt. Delusion can't wiggle its way in. Present experience running through the filter of thinking, of association and metaphor, that's the mycelium in which delusion thrives. If there's a how-to, then it's too late. If there's a how-to, then we've made our present symptom serious enough that it appears to be binding. And therefore, we need a how-to, right? Unwind from its nefarious influence. So you can't have a how-to. Because once you have a how-to, you have the so-called persistent loyalty to delusion, that it has, that it's solid enough that you require a how-to thwarted, headed off at the pass, transcend it or undermine it. But delusion doesn't have any legs. It doesn't really have any legs, so there's nothing to be done about it. So if we're not fussing with trying to remedy ourselves of delusion, delusion has no fuel. It goes away quite of its own accord. If you don't feed it by thinking that it's real enough to do something about, then it's, you could say its grip is released. Once delusion is serious enough that we need to do something about it, well, gotcha. You'll be doing something about delusion until the box. A delusion that was never actually binding in the first place. We really can't say what the nature of present experience is. It's not reducible to opposites, to contrast, to knowledge or thought. So we rest, if you will, we rest in this, you know, impish revelation that we don't know what this is. And by doing so, even for a, call it, short period of time, the myth of symptom and the myth of becoming is ameliorated. If our innocence goes so deep that we don't know what this is, and we sure as hell can't convince ourselves of being in a condition. A condition that requires remedial action. And it doesn't mean that you forget how to go to the grocery store and pick out a ripe or soon to be ripe avocado. You function with all manner of intelligence at your disposal, which is what we've always done. Functioned quite organically with all manner of intelligence at our disposal. But you're not looking to consciousness for any favors. If we're looking to consciousness for favors, then we're begging. We think that we are somehow the passive recipient of reality. But that's not the case. And all those fuckers that think there might be some use to creating reality? How dare they? Why on earth would you want to be bothered by to create reality so that it's somehow beneficial for what you think this is? I mean, the hubris of it is...
You mean like those three guys in the YouTube video?
Who's that? Joey Lott and friends?
Yeah.
Right. Those guys, they got it all together. They've figured this out.
They did.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, the burden of imagining that you can co-create or that you would even be interested in creating anything at all is so banal. But that's for a creature. They're like, oh, well, I can create health and parking spots and a soulmate that won't leave me and steal my money. Good luck. But you see, creating keeps you in the game as a creature in time that is bound by, you know, creature comforts and the avoidance of creature discomforts. So therefore, you want to have the magical powers to create. But you've just made yourself excruciatingly small because you're a beggar. You've signed up for being a consequence of comfort and discomfort of time. Create this, motherfucker. But you see, I mean, we humans, whatever that is, are really so pedestrian, so absurdly small-minded, either by choice or conditioning or perpetration, or by the will of Brahman, which is fine too. we can't imagine encountering a quality of experience that's truly transcendent. We have to reduce all of this new ageism to creature comfort. Jesus Christ. I mean, everyone is drunk with the hubris and arrogance and the pride of creature comfort. And knowledge. It's not likely that our allotted life on Earth is going to be perfected somehow. I mean, it's a metabolic ooze that is quickly rusting. What if you don't place any value in how you feel? Don't place any value in what you think, what you know. Don't place any confidence at all in this presentation of consciousness. Don't place any confidence at all in the presentation of experiencing as being binding. Maybe desire and restlessness just slip away. You know, the Indians are really good at fetishizing consciousness through their polytheism. And all of these great and miraculous deeds that are done by, you know, demons and heroes. So they make reality about something. So you have all of these gods and goddesses and creatures of all kinds that they're there to provide you with boons. So we pray to Saraswati and Durga and Kali and Ganesh and Krishna. Rom, 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 rom. Because that's going to get us somewhere. If you create the great, you end up with the small. Any other questions?
Not here.
You know, not that many people amongst the so-called species meditate. Many might pray and do rosaries of all kinds and, you know, do ritualized forms of worship. But I don't think all that many actually meditate in terms of an appointment with emptiness. And even all those Tibetans, you know, they just fill the airwaves with all kinds of exotic prayer noises and curious high altitude instruments. And then everyone gets confused by the ritual.
You mentioned earlier when you started, you were talking about just the ridiculous hubbub of life as a normal human being, you know, that you never slow down enough to say, what is this?
Yes.
It seems to me like meditation is an appointment to say, all right, I'm going to slow it down and I'm going to feel this.
Yes, I think it's fast or slow, the willingness to feel this, that's the difference.
But it seems to me like when you slow it down and you give yourself enough time to loiter or to meditate or just to not be so completely wrapped up in activity.
Yes.
It is more conducive to, wait a minute, what is that? Then a million miles an hour, constant distraction, doing, materialism and all that.
Yeah, sure. That's right.
I get that if you turn that slowing down or that meditating into a doing, that's no better than just anything else you do.
Yeah, right.
It's almost like hanging out with you doesn't feel much like a doing. There's some effort to get there or whatever, but there's not a lot of doing to it. It's pretty light. And yet, there is a doing. You know, we get together, I put the effort into showing up.
Well, sure, you know, hopefully one takes a relatively short walk to the meditation hall. And once there, if it pleases you or whomever, then use the time to rest. You know, you use the time for just curious consideration of the nature of being. You know, knowledge and so-called teachings or metaphors and stuff like that they're superficial. Make no sense. Permit your present experience to make no sense. To release you from the shackles of time or becoming or utilitarianism. It's like, get used to the luscious observation that you make no sense.
That's what most of the running around is about, is trying to get somewhere and make sense of something.
Yeah, it's hard to say what, you know, all the miraculous distraction and activity is inspired by. I mean, it's kind of, you know, just appearing as serendipitously as anything else is. It doesn't really have a, you know, practical or nefarious motive. I mean, all activity is the nature of activity. You know, the presentation of phenomena. Creatures on the go. You know, humans are creatures on the go, but, you know, so are ants or horses or ant eaters. I mean, everything is a creature on the go, even, you know, microbiological processes. All this weird shit's going on at these, you know, electron microscope levels of discernment within biologic structures. It's like everything's on the go. Mitochondria just, you know, loves a shot of glucose. So that, of course, you know, expresses itself in activity. I mean, even in so-called primitive cultures, you know, food storage and eating and farming or hunting and gathering or weaving and, no, we have a blast. I mean, in Anasazi culture, they were just consumed with making, you know, one cell after another, right? Their dwellings were just connected cells through, you know, walkways and windows and ladders, and they just built and built and built and built, you know? Yeah, so we're like bees that way. And, you know, in this culture, many cultures, you know, there's also time for leisure, right? Time for putting it all down. Time for resuscitating in not making sense.
Well, for you to imply or invite to take a look at, this doesn't mean anything, really flies in the face of, I think, what usually drives most people to some kind of seeking or religious practice or even, you know, addictions. It's that desire for meaning. We have an inherent yearning for some kind of meaning. And I guess it gets translated into meaning for the self. that's like the little eddy that it gets all wrapped up in instead of the bigger.
Yeah. Meaning is representational. You know, that's the urgency for meaning is, it's kind of like a book report or show and tell of some kind. Meaning is representational. It's virtual. Yeah.
Yeah. It's usually like, how do I make my life mean something? This, I have to be more than just a speck on this, the face of this pen.
Yeah, that's right. It could also be, you know, kind of retributional for how small we feel or insignificant or at risk.
I think that's a big drive. It's got to mean something. Meaning,
yeah.
I've got to make right. something of myself. I've got to, you know, give to other people or be as good as this other person or
yeah.
in other ways maybe as bad as some. You know, I got to get my share. And
yeah, so that's – so we're all suffering from this Napoleonic complex,
right? Yeah.
We're overcompensating for this being nothing. Yeah, we're unrelentingly overcompensating for this being nothing and how terrified we are of that revelation.
Hmm. Well, when you say this, this meaning the I being nothing.
No, experiencing consciousness, the entire presentation of, you know, phenomena. Yeah, not just the sense of a false I, but the entirety of the presentation of experiencing itself is not about anything.
But there's a sense for me when I get close, I get close. The taste that I've had, it's kind of there's like a heartfelt warmth that goes with it. Some might call it God, some might call it grace, or not grace, but I don't know, there's something more than just, oh, this is nothing. It's not just cold, outer space nothingness. There's a awe-inspiring and holy shit, this is what I've looked for my whole life that goes with it.
Well, it's funny. I would say the actual revelation is of nothing at all. Those you know, lovely comments are always after the fact. Those are adornments. It's not the adornments that we're after or the language that suggests adornments. It's the revelation that this is nothing. But that's not representational in common speech.
I don't think nothing would do it justice.
Fair enough. Yeah,
it's been nothing. I mean, we're all hungry for something, and it's surely not nothing.
Well, I would beg to differ. I think what it is that we're hungry for is nothing. Yeah.
Well, you don't always use that language. A lot of times you use a bit flowery, more flowery language.
Yeah, sure.
Infinitely effervescing effulgence, I believe.
Yeah, well, that's true, but that's also, that's nothing.
And that's
I mean, look at it. It is doing that. You know, it is effervescent.
Yeah. How do you define nothing, I guess?
Well, you can't define nothing. I mean, nothing is this as it is, just now, present in all of its effulgence. You see, you can't land anywhere. You can only land somewhere through meme or metaphor, conceptually, through assignment. Your actual experience is concomitantly or presently evaporative. It's so, but what's so? It's persistent, but it has no duration. So because you can't actually land anywhere, you can't claim anything, that's the revelation of its inherent emptiness. Even though it does not shy away from robust presentation. Present experience is not construed by self. It does not birth self. It's the revelation of emptiness itself, and it can obviously do what it pleases. We become convinced that the apparitional presentation is what this is about. And that's where all restlessness and sorrow and selfishness abound. But if we place no insistence on present experience or what it is we think we need to get from it, then it's quite possible it's truly void of self, truly void of consequence. Maybe those are a rough way of suggesting nothing, nothing at all. This isn't about anything. Your intelligence is not cluttered by content. Your intelligence is not cluttered by a demanding and whining sense of me. Or I, or my. Your intelligence is unbounded. No content bothers it. We can actually sense how feeling this gets triggered by concept or some form of inner entertainment or representation. That's the genesis of story creation. Creating a story, a reminiscence. Yes, Commissioner, I'll be right there. Robin's at the skating rink. I'll go pick him up.
Hmm.
The Riddler's at it again?
To the bat poles.
To the bat pole. We even have to make bats into phallic symbols. To the bat weenie. No, to the bat pole.
To the bat poles, Dick.
Right, to the bat poles, Dick. This is my ward, Dick Grayson. Hmm.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Yes, indeed. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff.
What fun.
See you again soon.
Okay. Rock on. Bye.